before you leave this morning, you can take a little piece, because there's not so much, but tulsi leaves that were right from the feet of Radha Shyama Sundar and Vrindavan. So I'm sure you won't forget. While in Vrindavan, I completed 18 and 19. And so now I'm going to continue from Canto 2. Why don't you get a Canto 2 for him? Continuing, as far as I can recall, continuing where I left off in America. So our recording person has to mark. It's in second chapter, and the first chapter is the first step in God realization. The first step in God realization has two main parts. Besides the introduction, Shukadeva Goswami first begins to speak, and even before he begins to speak, Sutta, the glories of Shukadeva Goswami, what's about to happen is enunciated. So there are two main parts to the first chapter. A principle of renunciation, Vairagya. The path of Nivritti, Nivritti Marg. There's Pravritti and Nivritti. Pravritti is Karmakanda. Pravritti is taking up the codes of the Vedas with a very specific purpose, and that is enhancing one's capacity for material enjoyment. Material elevation through in this life and after this life. Pravritti. And Nivritti is the path of decreasing one's dependency upon material things for one's subsistence and certainly for one's expectation of happiness, and at the same time increasing exclusive dependence upon the Supreme Lord. The path of Nivritti is the path of the Bhagavatam. So he introduces, Shukadeva Goswami introduces, not by name, but he's describing the vitality of Nivritti and the mentality of Nivritti. And he also, the main theme of the chapter is forming a conception of God when there isn't one. So there are places in the world where they have no conception of God. I mean, everyone, Prabhupada indicates that there's some conception of something as great, but not a clear conception of God. I'll just share this with you. There was in Urbana-Champaign, last time I was there, made a presentation where it was very interesting. There's a shift that's happening in America. A lot more Americans are again becoming interested in spiritual life. There was a period of time when what was happening was a great dependence upon security, job security, profession security, feeling insecure and wanting, that was numero uno. And spiritual life, if it fit in with that one, fine. And if it didn't fit in with that one, fine. Security, stability, preparing for the future. Now there's a wave of interest, again, in spirituality, where persons are willing to take a bold step in spirituality, even if it means putting aside for the time being that previous priority. And it's I'm sure there are places that are exceptions, but it seems to be all across the country. And that it's having its impact on a lot of America is people from other countries, people who have come from Europe, people who have come from, now there's a huge number of people from Asia and certainly India. So there was a large group of Americans and a large group of Asians, like, you know, Chinese or that part of the world. I don't know the difference between, by looking at people, where they're from, Korea, Hong Kong, China, and all those other places, Vietnam and Southeast Asia. So some good number of those people. And at the end of the presentation, immediately, one PhD student, Mataji, came forward and said, I came to this program because I want to learn about God. In China, there's a lot of good people. And they do good things. But there's no conception of God. So I came to America and to do my PhD work. And I've encountered so many different conceptions of God. She said, it's like a child being in a candy store. And that you've never been in before. It's, you know, wow. But there are so many conceptions that just don't resonate. Then she had a shoulder bag and patted the shoulder bag and said, in here there's a Bible. Because in my lab there's some Christians and they, you know, gave me the opportunity, invited me to come to their Bible study group. And I've been to the Bible study group and it's nice. But the conception of God is not clear. And when I saw the advertisement, I thought, this is Eastern conception of God. Let me go and find out. And that's why I'm here. I would like to learn from you about God. Wow. That's very nice. Thank you very much. And then she went on and said, I know what is the happiness of a research scholar. Then she went on to describe, this is what the happiness of a research scholar is like. And we go to conferences and we learn these things and we share with each other these things and we do these things. And I know what that happiness is. But the happiness from those who know God is a different kind of happiness. And I see in you and these others that that happiness is there and I want that. Wow. Sign up. But I'm really busy right now. So there's a discussion. Really busy with finishing up my PhD work, but I'm going to continue. And I'd like to learn more. So we're trying to help this Mataji. She's married. And her husband has not such an interest, the exact same interest that she has, but there are people that just don't have a conception of God. China traditionally is that kind of place. Now there are spiritually inclined people that don't have a conception of God, so the best is to be good. And so therefore Buddhism is very popular. Try to be good, be nonviolent. For what purpose? Just because you should be good. Just because it's good to be good. You should be ethical. Ethics for the sake of ethics. And it's just not, it's not that there is no God. It's not atheism. It's not overt atheism. It's just God's not in the picture. There's serenity of nature, a waterfalls, scene of a bird sitting on a rock, the dew hanging from the leaf of a tree, serenity. And in that, you're to experience God. It's not explicit, it's implicit. So the first chapter of the second canto is how to see God within nature. Specifically, how to see the various manifestations of nature as part of the body of God. There are different ways of trying to see God in nature. Here is specific. Just like what I portrayed a moment ago. That's in just the natural beauty of God's creation. You can get a sense of the Creator. Just like, you know, a piece of art, a sculpture or a painting. You see the beautiful detail of that painting and some mood of something that's in the painting, and it gives you an idea of the painter. Just like, you know, modern art, just stuff all over the place, and it gives you some idea of the painter. We were going for a morning walk once in Central Park in Manhattan, New York City. And we were walking and walking through Central Park, and it's just the one part of the walk, we just walked up a kind of a hill, and there's a little path, and you walk up a hill, and then you reach the top of the hill, and there's, I guess it's the Museum of Modern Art, because just before you get to this big, big, old, huge, impressive-looking building, is a sculpture of modern art. And Prabhupada walked in front of the sculpture and looked up at this twisted thing, and says, "This is the mind of modern man." And they call this art. Shook his head and just walked away. As behind a piece of art, or say music, some classical music, or this, I don't know if you are exposed to this stuff here. Anyway, the modes of nature that influence a person come out in artistic expression. In America, there's this rap music. Do you get that here? No, don't know. You guys know? You know what it is? You have an idea? It's like this anger. Wow. You know, four letter words and anything, just anything. It's just telling their story, and it's da 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 da. Wow. And people blast this stuff from their homes and their cars, and the cars are rocking like this as people anger. It's called music. So behind some expression of music or art or architecture, you get an idea of the consciousness of the person, because what's inside comes outside. So to appreciate God within nature is a classic, at least for a beginning. So Prabhupada describes in Nectar of Devotion, and so even for Aborigine people, a waterfall or a big mountain or something, a bird or a big giant tree or something. And that their tendency for worship comes because tendency for worship is within. So to move from the impersonal to a personal conception, this first step in God realization, chapter 1, discusses seeing God within nature in a specific way. The universal form, and the universal form that's described in Bhagavad Gita, is another version of or a perspective upon the universal form that's described here. It's the universal form. It's the universal form means form that the Supreme Lord assumes for the purpose of creation. He manifests himself in these ways. So here it's the hills are his stacks of bones, the rivers are his veins, the sun and the moon are his two eyes, and so forth and so on. Within nature, get some conception of God. The first step is to get a conception of God. Distinct from an impersonal conception. Beginning is a personal conception. Although the universal form is described, because it's temporary, it's imaginary. It's now you see it, now you don't. Now you see it, now you don't. So, but it is a form of the Lord. The ingredients of material energy are the Lord's energies. And he manifests them, or he manifests some sense of himself through them. Although it's illusory. Now you see it, now you don't. The real substance is elsewhere, and this is a reflection of that real substance. So as in reflection, it's like here, this is a mirror, and you see a reflection. There's no substance. There is substance, but not in the mirror. If it's reflection of a nice plate of Mahaprasadam, looks good, but you can't become nourished and satisfied by seeing the reflection or trying to enjoy the reflection. The substance is elsewhere. Prabhupada uses this language in the first canto. Substance and category. So over here is category. Here's prasadam. But it's just a reflection. And same, in this world, this is an idea that Plato came up with, but objects here are but categories of the substance that's in the spiritual world. I don't go through a whole Plato thing. But to see within this chair, this is the example that he specifically uses. We can understand before there was a chair, there was an idea of chair. Before there was an idea of chair, where did that idea of chair come from? There must be chairs that exist before these ones that come and go, before even the idea of one comes. He, by inference, there's a realm of absolutes, and there's substance, and here there's category. Same language in the Bhagavatam. Seeing God within nature is the category. It gives us an idea of the substance. The person. It's philosophical. And for people that are not philosophically inclined, they get really bored with this stuff. But it's a beginning. See within nature some conception of God. So that's first chapter. Second chapter is beyond. So now once some, by that practice, some conception of God as a person that exists beyond the facade of this creation, then comes meditation upon Lord in the heart. Meditation on God within nature, meditation on God within. Bahir Nishingo, Hridaye Nishingo. He's everywhere and he's within. So, in this chapter, there's two main themes. There's several things, but two main themes. Again, Nivritti. And the form of the Lord as he exists within. And it's not an imagination any more than the other one is. But specifically, this is a spiritual form. This is substance, not category. And the recommendation being given by Shukadev Goswami to Maharaj Parikshit is that one should meditate upon this form of the Lord within the heart, because he's responding, mind you, to the question, or two questions, that were asked by Maharaj Parikshit at the end of the first canto. Those two questions were, what's the duty of people in general? Because he's king, he's concerned about, or was king, he's concerned about his citizens. You're Shukadeva Goswami. All the sages assembled here, they respect you, and I can see why. Because you just emanate this transcendence. They've all offered their respect to you, and so do I, for so many reasons he's given. And now please instruct me, with all the sages listening, so they can also benefit from this. What's the ultimate duty for all mankind in general? And specifically, second question is, what is the duty for one who is about to die? Which is everybody also, but him specifically. So, this is the duty. Form a God conception and detach oneself from this world. Chapter 1. Form a spiritual conception of the form of the Lord within the heart and detach oneself from the world. It just so happens there's a theme of detachment that comes naturally by spiritual attachment. Detachment from illusory enjoyments fade. But one can explicitly cultivate that mood of detachment in different ways. So they're discussed. And what I just gave you is a summary of how far I got when in America. So now class is about to begin. The new material. And I'm going to begin with chapter 2, text number 6. I'm just going to read several verses, and then I'm going to expand on one purport. Actually, for the sake of the recording, these verses I'm reading are verses that I've already discussed, but just is to bring you up to speed. Thus being fixed, text number 6, one must render service unto the Supersoul, situated in one's own heart, by his omnipotency, because he is the almighty personality of Godhead, eternal and unlimited. He is the ultimate goal of life. And by worshipping him, one can end the cause of the conditioned state of existence, nivritti, through the positive contemplation on transcendence. Who else but the gross materialists will neglect such transcendental thought and take to the non-permanent names only, seeing the mass of fallen people in the river of suffering as the consequence of accruing the results of their own work? Beautiful poetry, huh? I mean, that's a poetic expression, the poetry of the Bhagavatam, describing with a simple dismissal the whole gamut of pursuit of material happiness, life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness. All men, this American statesmanship, all men are created equal. They are endowed with their creator with certain inalienable rights, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. That's Abraham Lincoln. Here's Shukadev Goswami. Who else but the gross materialists will neglect such transcendental thought and take to the non-permanent names only, seeing the mass of people fallen in the river of suffering as the consequence of accruing the result of their own work. They built a big memorial for Abraham Lincoln for making such nice statesmanship sayings. Where's the memorial for Srimad Bhagavatam and Shukadeva Goswami? They have some statue of him as you go from Hyderabad to Secunderabad, where Shukadeva Goswami is speaking, so that the birds can come and put their droppings on his head. But the culture where the eternal value of life is made so prominent, it's missing. Although there's traces of it, it's going. Needs to be brought back up again. Others conceive of the personality of Godhead residing within the body, in the region of the heart, and measuring only 8 inches, like between the thumb and the forefinger, like that. It's not that he's limited by some material measure, it's just to give some idea. With 4 hands, carrying a lotus wheel of a chariot, conch shell, and club, respectively. Now here's a description of Shukadeva Goswami is giving to Maharaj Parikshit, very much like the description that Narada gave to Dhruva Maharaj of the form of the Lord. Very beautiful, beautiful description. How to fix the mind upon the form of the Lord in the heart. It's explicit. His mouth expresses his happiness. His eyes spread like the petals of a lotus. And his garments, yellowish like the saffron of a kadamba flower, are bedecked with valuable jewels. His ornaments are made of gold set with jewels, and he wears a glowing headdress, like helmet, and earrings. His lotus feet are placed over the whirl of a lotus, of the lotus-like hearts of great mystics. On his chest is the Kastuba jewel engraved with a beautiful calf. And there are other jewels on his shoulders. His complete torso is garlanded with fresh flowers. He is well decorated with an ornamental wreath about his waist, and rings studded with valuable jewels on his fingers. His leglets, his bangles, his oiled hair curling with a bluish tint, and his beautiful smiling face are all very pleasing. And then the verse that I'm going to read something from the purport. Text 12, the Lord's magnanimous pastimes and the glowing glancing of his smiling face are all indications of his extensive benedictions. In other words, he's giving his benedictions just by smiling. His smile is his benediction. One who can see that smile, that's receiving the Lord's benediction. One must, therefore, concentrate on this transcendental form of the Lord as long as the mind can be fixed on him by meditation. So please know that the next chapter is pure devotional service, change in heart. So this is an intermediate stage, progressive from having no conception of God, forming some, then understanding the form of the Lord in the heart, and then pure devotional service. In his purport, Prabhupada preempts the next chapter by describing the process of meditation herein is bhakti yoga, or the process of devotional service after one is liberated from the material conditions. He says several interesting things, so I'm just going to read and then elaborate. Gyan Yoga is the process of liberation from the material conditions. Gyan Yoga. Gyan Yoga is discerning the difference between matter and spirit, like the Sankhya section of Chapter 2 Bhagavad Gita. This is matter, that's spirit. The properties are different. One who can understand the difference between matter and spirit, discerning of the two, it's part of the exercise of Gyan Yoga, so that one can detach oneself from matter and situate oneself in spirit. And if that distinction isn't clear, how can you do that? In our Western philosophy, the most brilliant of Western philosophers of Europe and the big thinkers hardly can make a distinction between the mind and the self. Or what's the difference between the mind and the intelligence? Or the self? When Prabhupada was speaking with Cardinal Daniel Yu, he was saying the distinction between the animal and the human is rational faculty. We just have a developed mind. And therefore, we have soul. Prabhupada's reply was, where is that in your scripture? And he didn't answer. He just went on with his ideology. And because the animal has no soul, there's no sin for taking the life of the animal, because they don't have rational faculty. And that's cardinal. Top of the heap. So that's our situation. People that are the topmost teachers of theology don't know the difference between the mind and the soul. So they're not at the stage of detachment from material involvement. They're at the position of rationalizing material involvement, exploiting the weaker because we're stronger, because we have rational faculty and we can feel good about it, so we can take the life of other living beings in the name of serving God. Very sad. Gyan Yoga is the process of liberation from the material conditions. After one is liberated from the conditions of material existence, that is, when one is nivritta, as previously stated herein, or where one is freed from all material necessities, one becomes qualified to discharge the process of bhakti yoga. So this is in the yoga ladder. One can perform karma yoga to detach oneself from the fruit of work, so that in that detached mode, one can cultivate knowledge of the eternal soul. When one has well situated oneself in knowledge of the eternal soul, then the eternal soul can engage in service to the supreme soul. Right? Like this Anamoya, Gyanamoya, Vijnanamoya, Anandamoya, those stages that are found in Bhagavad Gita. Anamoya, Pranamoya, Gyanamoya, Vijnanamoya, Anandamoya. So, once again, Gyan Yoga's detachment, the fruit of it is detachment from material necessities. Then one can take up devotional service to the Supreme Soul, being situated in an understanding of my real necessity is of the soul. So then there's a parallel Vedic process And that is taking up devotion to the personality of Godhead directly. Prabhupada writes, therefore, bhakti yoga includes gyan yoga. Or in other words, the process of pure devotional service simultaneously serves the process of gyan yoga. Semicolon. Liberation from material conditions is automatically achieved by gradual development of pure devotional service. Liberation from material conditions is anartha nivritti. So one takes up devotional service, bhajana kriya, right? Adavashratha, tata sadhu sangha, bhajana kriya. So then, anartha nivritta syat. It follows. So you take up devotional service. The benefit to be derived from gyan yoga is within devotional service. There has to be basic sambandh to gyan. One has to be properly directed. Properly directed. Again, proper, because one can be improperly directed. One can follow Cardinal Danilyu and think animals have no soul, and therefore so forth, so on. And that's not going to lead to detachment from material, the spirit of material enjoyment. It's a disservice. It's shameful. Anyway, Hare Krishna. So properly directed devotional service with proper sambandha gyan can take one to the position of the full benefit of gyan yoga. We don't need to separately cultivate gyan yoga. Just follow the process of bhakti yoga properly directed. The fruit of gyan yoga is already there. What is that? Detachment from dependence upon material things for happiness, and even thinking that they're going to bring happiness. It's taken care of if one, under proper direction, follows the bhakti yoga process. Gyan yoga is a subset in mathematical language. Things that are artificially acquired gradually disappear along with the process of bhakti yoga, and then so the rest, practically two full pages, is dedicated to speaking about the number one anartha, or that which binds one to illusory conception, and that's sex attraction. One cannot be this kind of a transcendentalist performing meditation upon the Lord in the heart and not have control of this feature of life. One cannot. And so within the bhakti process, there's a means of bringing about that purification. Part of it is having proper sambandha gyan, understanding what is the soul, what is real happiness, what is that attraction that people are feeling towards this, the material enjoyment of sex life. I'll just go down middle of the next page in the purport. Knowledge means knowing things as they are. And if by deliberation it is found that there are things which are at all unnecessary, naturally the person who has acquired knowledge leaves aside such unwanted things. When the conditioned soul finds, by culture of knowledge, that material necessities are themselves unwanted things, he becomes detached from such unwanted things. This stage of knowledge is called vairagya. Jnana, vairagya. This couplet is there throughout Vedic wisdom. That's the purpose of cultivation of knowledge, or the fruit of it, is detachment. We have previously discussed that the transcendentalist is required to be self-sufficient and should not beg from the rich blind persons to fulfill their bare necessities of life. Shukadeva Goswami, this is the nivritti that comes in chapters 1 and chapter 2. Sukadeva Goswami has suggested some alternatives for the bare necessities of life, namely the problems of eating, sleeping, and shelter. But he has not suggested any alternative for sex satisfaction. And there's a reason why. Here's the reason why. One who has the sex desire still within him should not at all try to accept the renounced order of life. For one who has not attained to this stage, there is no question of a renounced order of life. He just said it twice. So, by the gradual process of devotional service under the guidance of a proper spiritual master and following the principles of the Bhagavatam, one must be able at least to control the gross sex desire before one accepts the renounced order of life factually. So then there's this gradual purification process which most people fall under, unless they're very fortunate. The gradual purification process of the Vedic system is there. So, purification means getting free gradually from sex desire. And this is attained by meditating on the person of the Lord, as described herein, beginning from the feet. One should not try to go upwards artificially without seeing for himself how much he has been released from the sex desire. Then he goes on, Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur clearly defines the import of purification as cessation from sex indulgence. For want of time, I'm not going to read the Sanskrit, but it's very nice. And the essence of this idea is purification. The from the 19th chapter of the first canto, Prabhupada describes that there are three things. Well, because Maharaj Pariksit says, by neglect of these three things, I'm now a sinful person. Neglect of the respect for Brahminical culture. Respect for Brahminical culture helps one become detached from further material involvement. It brings one to the mode of goodness, but ultimately, if qualified brahmanas are there, it brings one to the position of transcendence. By God consciousness, by meditation upon the personality of Godhead, my past reactions for sins and indulgences and bad activities become removed. Just by this meditation upon the form of the Lord within the heart, or the further description that's going to come, the process of devotional service, the rendering of active duties in serving the Supreme Lord, purifies the heart from the contaminations of previous material contact and cow protection. For neglect of these things, now I'm in a degraded position, and all of the followers, all my citizens, will similarly become degraded, because if the head is degraded, the followers will be degraded. So the standard, Prabhupada is indicating here, according to Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, for purification is progressively sex desire, not just controlling the urge, but becoming freed from the urge. Now, as long as there's embodiment, the scriptures indicate that urge will be there, just like you get hungry because you have a body. You get tired because you have a body. So eating and sleeping are going to be there because you have a body. And mating and defending, tendency will be there because you have a body. But to be able to purification, the test of purification is that urge is well under control. It has subsided to a very clear and at least under the codes of theistic conduct procedure for eating, sleeping, defending, and mating. Now, again, Shukadeva Goswami has given alternatives than the standard, you know, mega materialistic program for eating, sleeping, and defending. And he doesn't give, you know, a nice, neat little alternative for mating or sex life. It's meant to be not just sublimated by, you know, like, putting it under the rug and just pretend it's not there, but by purification. For the service of the personality of Godhead, each thing is created, and there's some purpose. And otherwise, it doesn't have utility. So here's how Prabhupada concludes the purport, and I'm going to have to end the class at 7:30. So I'm going to go a little faster towards the end here. As one gets free from the intoxication of sex indulgence by purification of intelligence, one should step forward to the next meditation, or in other words, the progress of meditation on the different limbs of the transcendental body of the Lord should be enhanced in proportion to the progress of purification of the heart. What is it? Now he restates that. The conclusion is that those who are still entrapped by sex indulgence should never progress to meditation above the feet of the Lord, meaning the first two cantos of Srimad Bhagavatam. Therefore, recital of Srimad Bhagavatam by them should be restricted to the first and second cantos of the great literature. One must complete the purification process by assimilating the contents of the first nine cantos. Then one should be admitted into the realm of the tenth canto of Srimad Bhagavatam. And the part that I skipped is the Prabhupada uses the word the upstarts who take the their audience right away to the tenth canto of the Bhagavatam, perform their Bhagavat Saptaha. People pay them sumptuously and they go back to their material activities, and the worldly people go back to their material activities, and there's no change. So this focus upon very carefully understanding the message, not just here, not just intellectually understanding, but assimilating the message in the quality of one's life. Shrinvanti gayanti grinanti sadavaha. That phrase is used several times in the Bhagavatam, like a refrain. Hearing, chanting, and imbibing or internalizing, realizing, assimilating the message, living according to that message, then you're at the lotus feet of the Supreme Lord. The first two cantos are meant to bring one to the lotus feet of the Supreme Lord, to that state of purification, where the desire that's dormant in the heart has significantly become awakened. I want to take shelter of the Lord's lotus feet. I feel a happiness, a contentment in that position, and that protects me from this other attraction, the materialistic ways of eating, sleeping, mating, defending, attraction. Just not attracted. And I can stay very peaceful and very contentedly situated in that position. Even the other stuff is going on around me, because that's what's going on around us. Materialistic civilization is very strong, in case you hadn't noticed. It's very strong. And through technology, stronger and stronger and stronger, faster, more. Degradation rate is so fast. So what's our shelter? Shelter is Srimad Bhagavatam. Precisely. The question of the sages of Naimisharanya in the first chapter, where the shelter of religious principles, now that Krishna has gone, the shelter is in the form of the lotus feet of the Supreme Lord in these first two cantos of Srimad Bhagavatam. Regularly hearing them, regularly discussing them, and assimilating them. And then, even the age of Kali is so harsh, so negatively surcharged, one can progress further and further and further and further in spiritual realization when one has to be fixed at the lotus feet of the Supreme Lord. Hare Krishna. Oh, some time for questions if you like. Yes.
Maharaj, the descriptions are so beautiful, and practically, even though the whole process is given to us, so many devotees get deviated.
Sure.
What is it that they're doing wrong in principle? But they seem to be sincere and following some, but at the same time, it's
not necessarily they're doing something wrong. It's, well, the phrase that I've been using the past couple of years is that they've accepted the process of Krishna consciousness in their minds, but not in their hearts. And so the mind is flickering. The mind says yes, and the modes of nature go all over the place. And sometimes the modes of nature are very strong, and I mean, a classic is when you first started here, Hare Krishna. You know, just getting MTV-ized. You know, he was sincere. Just every time he walked into the hostel, there's this. Then he would sit down and, you know, contemplate the objects of the senses. And the next thing was the next thing, and he got dragged away by the material energy, although he was sincere. So his mind was saying yes, but his senses were dragging him. And I'm sure he hasn't forgotten the Krishna conscious contact that he had, but I'm sure he's, you know, I imagine at least he's far from what that promise was. So there, to say the same thing in another way, there has to be submission. And that submission has to be regularly renewed, or ongoing submission. It's not an event. It's a process. There's ongoing submission. And when that ongoing submission takes place, the taste increases. Like Dhruva Maharaj, when he started, he was determined, but he didn't let go of that determination. His submission didn't slacken. His taste just grew and grew beyond his even ability to conceive of, to the point where his motivation was gone. The material motivation. So, another way of saying the same thing, but we start in a sakkama position. Four types of people render devotional service unto me. And they've got their list of the things that they want. And when those things that they want get satisfied, is there ongoing submission? And there will not be unless you come to another position. I want a relationship with Krishna. Not just I want my desire fulfilled. Otherwise, sakkama will take one away to another position besides the position of submission. So the essence of submission to that relationship with the personality of Godhead must take place. And it's something that each individual needs to do. The process isn't going to do it for them. Or someone else will not do it for them. Someone else can help them, but they can't do it for them. It's a conscious choice each individual needs to make. And so there may be some initial sincere submission. And when submission slackens, because my wish list got fulfilled, thank you very much, see you later, Krishna. I mean, one may not officially address Krishna like that, but that's what happens. And some people, it's literal. I got what I wanted, see you later. Thanks a lot. Because there's no culture. I mean, it's the way of material life. You receive something from somebody and you thank them and you're on your way. You never see them again.
At least in material life, people don't become offensive. But here,
sure, they become offensive. Left and right. I mean, you know, walk out your front door.
When you say they don't dwell on a person and criticize him and bring him down and bring him down the other.
They do that. They do that. I'm sorry, but they do that.
To each other?
Yeah. Just, you know, your colleagues.
But there's no targeted enemy about a particular person. Here there is a...
Oh. Well, that's because, you know, Krishna is God. The scientists, you know, they want God to disappear. It's targeted. But, you know, it goes to other people too. Somebody that stands in the way, you know. They've got their weapons, and they deploy them. But that envy towards others is but envy towards Krishna. There is certainly envy in this world. I beg to differ.
No, I'm not saying that. What I'm saying is, when a devotee becomes weak in Krishna consciousness,
they need some justification. They don't want to feel guilty. You know, some persons have honesty and dignity, and they understand the real situation is I'm weak. But I don't have any disregard or disrespect for that standard. It's not within my capacity at the present time, which means I've made other choices. But some persons are they don't have integrity. So they have to get behind, you know, the sandbag and get their gun out. Because they feel threatened. But your question started with, why do people who have some sincerity fall away? What is they're doing wrong? It's they may have done right, but then they slacken because their desires were met, and that initial impetus has now faded. So what's the impetus to carry on? So without the impetus to carry on, you know, I can. There are different modes of nature that then take hold of a person. Some in the mode of goodness, some in the mode of passion, some in the mode of ignorance. Some are in the mode of ignorance, but some are in the mode of goodness. But just they're not prepared to make a relationship with Krishna. They just want to be mode of goodness. Just before coming to India, I met with some devotees, and that was their position. They've stopped. They're not inimical. They're respectful. They're just not prepared to offer everything to Krishna. And they're content being, you know, pious vegetarians. That's mode of goodness. And some people, it's mode of passion. Compete. Some people, it's mode of ignorance. Destroy. Lord Chaitanya is most merciful. Prabhupada, being a representative of Lord Chaitanya, was most merciful. He understood. People will come, people will go. That when they've come, that benefit they've gotten is eternal benefit. Even if they become offensive. So they'll suffer for those offenses, but that benefit will stay with them eternally. And when the offense reaction subsides, they still have that asset. It's 7:30, and I have to disappear. Thank you very much, Srila Prabhupada Ki.